Okay, good morning and welcome to Bio 231. Today's Wednesday and it's April 18th. We got the schedule on the projector right now. Let's take a look and see where we are. 18th, we're just a little bit behind, but that's not too bad. We're special senses, we should be on the heart. Well, we'll get to the heart. And the nice thing is this week we didn't have any lecture exams or practicums this week. All right, but next week, week 13, we do have the fourth practicum in lab, but no lecture exams. All right, but that means, though, that the week after next week, on Wednesday, we will have a lecture exam, okay, covering up to the heart. All right, so that's still a couple of weeks away, but lab practicums starting next week, and in lab we cover all the materials for what you need for those practicums. All right, so does anybody have any questions on the schedule, what we should be doing? All right, so today we're going to have a lecture on special senses, and that's chapter 16. And we're going to start by talking about, what the heck is a special sense, as opposed to another kind of sense, which we call a general sense. So basically we could break down all the senses, all the sensory perception in our body into either being special or general. And a general sense means that you have receptors for that particular modality of energy all over your body. And for instance, a nice general sense would be temperature, because you can feel temperature all over your body. If I took an ice cube and put it on your earlobe, could you tell that was cold? Sure. If I put it on your belly button, could you tell it was cold? Or in the middle of your back, or on your kneecap, or your popliteal region, or axilla, or whatever. You could tell that was a cold ice cube, right? No matter what. All right, but a special sense means that you can appreciate that energy, that modality of energy, in only one location on your body, or maybe two, because we're bilateral. And so if I took a flashlight and shined a light on your belly button, could you see it? Oh, you got a question about that. I should have brought a flashlight into class. But could you see a flashlight if I shined it right on your belly button? No, you couldn't. Or on your earlobe. Or on your back. Okay? But if I shine a flashlight just right on your eyes, guess what? You can see it. But nowhere else on your body. So vision is a special sense, because they have to have very specialized organs in order to perceive that modality of energy. There are some other kinds of sensations that are special as well. And that is, if I take a sugar cube and put it on your tongue, can you taste it? Yes. But if I take that sugar cube and put it on the tip of your nose, can you taste it? Or your belly button, or your earlobe? You can't taste it, right? So taste is also a special sense. It's not a general sense. You can only taste with your tongue. You can't taste with your fingertips. If you picked up a sugar cube, you couldn't tell if it was a cube of salt or a cube of sugar, right? Okay. So taste is special. And the same thing for odorant molecules. If I have some perfume and I put some perfume on your toes, could your toes tell you that that was perfume? No, right? But on your nose, you could definitely tell. And so you can sense odor molecules only via your nose. So smell is a special sense as well. And the sense of smell is called olfaction. The olfactory sense is for smell, and you know a little bit about the olfactory bulbs, where they are from neuroanatomy that we've been studying, so olfaction is one. The sense of taste also has kind of a funny name to it. It's called the gustatory sense. Gustation is taste. That is special, because you can only taste with taste buds that are on your tongue. So olfaction, gustation, vision, and what about hearing? Okay, hearing is special as well, because if we plug up your ears, you won't be able to hear anything. You can't hear with your elbow or your fingertips or knuckles or anything like that, only your ears. All right, so we got olfaction, gustation, vision, hearing, and then there's two more that have to do with equilibrium. And equilibrium senses are associated very closely with your hearing apparatus inside the temporal bone. And there are two kinds. There is one for linear acceleration, and we call that static equilibrium. And then there's another for an angular acceleration or spinning, and we call that kinetic equilibrium. So kinetic for spinning and static equilibrium for linear acceleration. So you got linear versus angular or spinning acceleration. All right, so let's take a look at some of these organs right here. Olfaction. What's that sense of olfaction once again? Smell. Okay. All right, so airborne molecules called odors have to bind to receptors in your nasal cavity. All right, so let's take a look at your nasal cavity. Here it is right here. So here's your nasal cavity, and I can see the nasal conchae right here. And here's the olfactory bulb, just right inferior to the frontal lobe. And there are nerves from the olfactory bulb that project through the cribriform plate and the ethmoid bone that actually dangle down inside your nasal cavity. And there are receptors for molecules, odorant molecules that we breathe into our nose. And actually, if you want to smell something, where do these odorant molecules have to go? Can they just slip right down beneath this inferior nasal conchae into your lungs? Or where do they actually have to go in order for you? Yeah, they got to go way up here, right to the roof of the nasal cavity. So if you really want to perceive a very faint odorant molecule, what do you have to do? You actually have to sniff it, right? You got to get that air going up to the roof of the nasal cavity because that's where these olfactory nerves are. All right, but here we see that nice cribriform plate with the olfactory foramina. And here's an epithelium that's lining the ethmoid bone. And in the epithelium are some bipolar neurons. And a bipolar neuron is a sensory neuron that is always associated with a special sense, not a general sense, like temperature or pain or something like that. All right, can you see this is a nice bipolar neuron because there are two main projections? Here are the olfactory filaments or olfactory cilia that are just dangling inside your nasal cavity. So this is pretty rough environments because anything you breathe into your nose can affect these neurons because they are right there. So these neurons typically don't live for a very long period of time. There are stem cells within the epithelium right here that replace the bipolar cells every so often because these bipolar cells die, depending on what kind of environment you're in. And I suppose if you're in a very caustic environment, maybe unfortunately you inhaled some acid or something that might actually kill these stem cells and you might lose the sense of smell forever as a result of that. Right? So this is kind of interesting because these nerve cells do regenerate each other or can regenerate from the stem cells that are in the epithelium, within the olfactory epithelium. And then the bipolar cells synapse with mitral cells in the olfactory bulb and then axons from the mitral cells join together and form the olfactory tract that takes that information to the brain for your appreciation. Okay, so what are some of these senses that you can perceive? Let's go right here. There are seven primary odors, but there are thousands of different kinds of receptors. So here are some of the primary odors, and in order for you to identify a particular kind of substance, what your nose does and what your brain does is it breaks it down into these fundamental kinds of smells, like flowery, okay? That's, should know what flowery means, and etheric, kind of smells like ether. I don't know if anybody knows what ether smells like anymore, but camphorous maybe, like mothballs. And then here are some compounds that produce that kind of sensation, bind to receptors in the nose. Okay, and rotten, you all know what rotten smells like, that's a sulfur smell. Okay, and depending on the components of these different smells, then you can identify a particular compound. Okay? Okay. So that would be part stinging acid, okay, and maybe part of these other ones over here as well. And there can be other different receptors that participate as well. Smell is a very complicated sense, right? So there are thousands of receptors and then here are only seven of them, okay? Yeah, so probably ammonia would even have a camphorous component to it as well. Okay, so we talked about the mitral cells, the synapse in the olfactory bulb, the olfactory tract, all right? And in order for you to smell something, there actually has to be a molecule that binds to receptors in the cilia right here. So if there is an odorant molecule sitting in the corner of the room over there, guess what? Can you smell it? No, that molecule actually has to enter your nasal cavity and bind to these receptors. You can't smell something at a distance. It actually has to be right inside your nose in order for you to smell it. All right, so that's the sense of olfaction. All right, the next sense, gustation. Well, there are taste buds found on your tongue. So, for instance, here is your tongue. And you probably look at your tongue, or somebody's looked at your tongue when you go see the doctor, and maybe you've looked at your tongue, and it's not a smooth, shiny surface. It's kind of a velvety surface, right? It has a lot of bumps on it. And those bumps that you can see with your naked eye, a lot of times people call those taste buds, and you know you do have taste buds on your tongue, but those are not taste buds. Those are things that we call papillae, okay? Okay, and different parts of the tongue have different kinds of papillae, like the fungiform or the smaller ones, the more feathery ones down by the tip of the tongue, and the valate are more in the back, they're bigger, okay, and there's even some lingual papillae toward the very back of the tongue, and there's even some tonsils on the back of the tongue. All right, well, let's look at one of those papillae. Okay, so here is a papillae right here, which is what you can see with your naked eye. And then down within the folds of the papillae, there are taste buds. And let's zoom into this region right here. And this is a taste bud that lines the different papillae that are on your tongue. And so I see a cell, right? I see some gustatory epithelial cells. I see some basal cells as well. Okay, and these gustatory cells have cilia poking up off of them with receptors on them, right? And so a tastant molecule has to dissolve in saliva and then enter a taste pore and bind to receptors on these cilia of these taste cells. All right, so these are cells right here. Can you see cells with your naked eye? What do you need to see a cell? You need a microscope, right? You need a microscope. So what can you tell me about the size of this taste bud right here? If you stick your tongue out in a mirror and look at it, can you see taste buds? You cannot, because they're microscopic structures. What you see are papillae, and lining all the papillae are hundreds or thousands of taste buds. So you need a microscope to see these different structures. All right, so, and again, those molecules have to dissolve in saliva to bind to receptors on these taste cells over here in order for you to perceive whatever molecule that is. All right, so you have then electrical signals that develop on these neurons that then enter via the vagus nerve and facial nerve and glossopharyngeal nerve, right, to the medulla where they synapse, right, and these are nice sensory neurons because you can see these are nice pseudo-unipolar neurons right here. And then here's a second order neuron that takes information from the pons to the thalamus. And then what's the job of the thalamus? It's a relay station for taking sensory information and directing it to the proper part of the cerebral cortex for your appreciation. And the gustatory cortex is right here. It's kind of between the frontal lobe and the temporal lobe, or between the parietal, right at the junction of the parietal and temporal lobe, right above the temporal lobe, right in this location. So that if we were to electrically stimulate this part of the brain, what would happen? Would you move, or would you see something, or would you feel something on the surface of your body, or what would happen? You would actually taste something, right? So this is the part of the brain that's responsible for taste. And for instance, if somebody has a stroke, for instance, and this part of the brain dies, okay, what will happen is that you'll still have motion all over your body, just right, you'll still be able to see and talk, but you just won't be able to taste anything because this is the part of the cerebral cortex responsible for taste, and we call that the insula, the gustatory cortex in the insula, right here. Okay, so that's part of taste. What else do we want to say about taste? Okay, there are primary taste sensations, just like for smell, okay, and the primary taste sensations are sweet, so you have taste buds for sweet, you have taste buds for sour. Right, that would be like an acid taste, like lemon juice, for instance, and bitter, and salt. You know what salt tastes like. And then The fifth one is umami, and that gives your body the sensation of fulfillment or deliciousness. Right? So when you eat a delicious food, it has chemicals like glutamate in it, which stimulates the umami sensory receptors on the tongue. And then you can identify a particular food item by the proportion of these different tastes that you're experiencing at one time. Okay, like what kind of food might have many of these primary taste sensations? I could be thinking of one, because we just had a holiday weekend not too long ago. I think of, margaritas, of course. Because what does a margarita have? Oh, a little bit of salt, right? A little bit of sweet, a little bit of bitter, some sour in there. And is it good? Yeah. Some of you, yeah, it's pretty good, right? So it's got to be stimulating these umami receptors as well. Okay. So depending on what the food is, right, you can tell what it is by these different components. All right, so that's the sense of gustation. All right, let's go on to vision. Vision is a special sense because you need eyes in order to see light. So light is the stimulus. It's the energy that is picked up by photoreceptors in the eye. And vision requires some accessory structures that are not directly involved in vision. And then some structures that are directly involved in vision that I have down on this list over here. So let's look at some accessory structures that help the eye do its job and maybe even protect the eye. Well, you have eyebrows right above your eyes that prevent foreign objects from falling from your head into your eyes. Okay, it also gives you some sensation. So if you brush up against something, that will automatically cause a blinking reflex and that protects your eyes again. Right, and if something bumps into your eyebrows, that causes your eyelids to close, and an eyelid is a palpebra. That's the scientific name for it. Okay, so let's see if I can find a palpebra. I think I got some slides to look at right here. Ah, here's a pretty good one. Right, so you can see the eyebrows. Here's a palpebra. It's labeled eyelid. This is a superior palpebra. Here's the inferior palpebra. And then here's the palpebral fissure, which is the opening between the eyelids. And then you got some eyelashes, again, for sensory perception that causes blink reflexes when something is, okay, close to your eye that protects your eye from lacerations and punctures and things like that. On the surface of the eye, we didn't talk about this in lab, but on the surface of the eye, and it's continuous with the inside lining of a palpebrae, is a membrane. And that's called the conjunctiva. We can find it over here on this illustration. So here is the conjunctiva. Here's the palpebral conjunctiva because it's lining an eyelid. And then here is the bulbar conjunctiva that's lining, okay, the exterior surface of the eye. Usually we don't consider that a layer of the eyeball proper. It's just a special covering that keeps the eye moist. Okay, and there are some glands that are in the palpebra. Here's a tarsal gland. A tarsal gland secretes a watery solution, but a little oil as well. A little lipid solution on the eye, and it helps lubricate the eye so it doesn't dry out. That's not the most important gland for lubricating the eye. Does anybody know what the most important gland is? The lacrimal gland. That's in a different location. We're going to find it pretty soon. Okay, but nonetheless, the tarsal gland is pretty important. Lacrimal gland pretty much just secretes a water and salty solution, but this tarsal gland also a little bit of a lipid solution, which prevents desiccation of the eye to a greater extent. And then here you see some eyelashes right here. Okay, the other thing I see on this slide is the sclera. Okay, and attached to the sclera are some extrinsic eye muscles. Those are accessory eye structures as well that can position the eye. You can look up, you can look down, right and left without turning your head. And that's important for light, right? It positions the eye so light falls on the most sensitive part of the retina that we call the macula lutea and the fovea centralis in the very center of the macula lutea. That's what the job of these extrinsic eye muscles are. And there's six of them. Okay, let's see if we can find the six of them. All right, so we got lateral rectus, superior rectus, inferior, and then there's a medial rectus as well, and then there's a superior and an inferior oblique extrinsic eye muscle. And on this table right here, it tells you what cranial nerves, right, activate these particular extrinsic eye muscles, and you notice most of them are which one? Oculomotor, which is number 3. Right, what's cranial nerve number 1, just for fun? Olfactory. Cranial nerve number 2 is optic, right? Cranial nerve number 3, oculomotor. That's why that saying is always starts with a bunch of O's. On Olympus's towering top, on old Olympus's towering top, a Finn and German view to hop. Okay, now what about number 6 right here, abducens? We see that it goes to a rectus muscle in the eye. Why do we call that the abducens nerve? What muscle does it go to in the eye? The lateral rectus. And when the lateral rectus contracts, what happens to the eye? It moves away from midline, right? It moves away or subtracts from your body. What do you call that? Abduction, right? So that's a really easy cranial nerve to know, right? The abducen causes abduction of the eye, or making the eyeball look to the side. But don't do that with both eyeballs at the same time. Okay, because what did your mother tell you? Yeah, your eyes will get stuck like that. It's probably a lie, but anyway, don't do it. Don't try it at home. Okay. Okay, so those are accessory structures of the eye. What else do we have? Okay, the lacrimal gland. Oh yeah, let's look at that lacrimal gland. Okay, so here's the lacrimal gland. It's superior and lateral to the globe. Okay, you're adducting there. Okay, so here's the lacrimal gland. It produces tears, right? When it is stimulated, the tears then exit the lacrimal gland through the excretory ducts. These are thin ducts to the superior part of the eye and lateral part of the eye. Then tears flow down by gravity, then more medially to the caruncle right here. And there is an opening of another duct, which is called the lacrimal punctum. And then that enters the lacrimal canaliculus, and then tears flow into the lacrimal sac, and this lacrimal sac produces a little lacrimal fossa in the lacrimal bone. I think you had to learn about the lacrimal bone and the lacrimal fossa of the lacrimal bone, and then it enters the nasal lacrimal duct right into your nasal cavity. All right, so if you're really teary-eyed, like when you're crying, that's why you get a runny nose too. Not because you have a runny nose, but because you have tears running from your eye into your nose. Just like that. Okay. So those are accessory structures. All right, now let's look at the layers of the eye. This is just a really nice fast review from lab. Here's a good view. So here's an exam figure. You've been quizzed on this in lab already. All right, but starting with the layers, there are 3 main layers. The top one, the outermost layer, is the sclera, right? Except on the anterior pole of the eye, the sclera becomes the cornea, and it becomes very delicate, easy to damage, and it's transparent. The sclera is tough and not transparent at all. Light can't get through it, but the cornea is absolutely clear. It has a certain curvature to it, so it can bend light as well. The next deepest layer is the choroid. Its job is to carry blood vessels to the interior part of the eye. So the choroid has blood vessels in it. Also has some pigments so that when light enters the eye, it doesn't bounce around inside your eye, because if it were to bounce around and reflect inside your eye, what would happen? You'd see a primary vision of image with a bunch of flashes all over the place. Okay, so that wouldn't help your vision at all. So the choroid does have some pigments. And then the third and deepest layer is the retina. It contains mostly nervous tissue, neuronal tissue, and also photoreceptors. All right, and as a matter of fact, you should only have photoreceptors in the retina and not blood vessels, because if there's a blood vessel right here, then that pushes photoreceptors out of the way. And then what will happen if photoreceptors are pushed out of the way in this region right here? You'll have a blind spot in that area, right? Okay, so blood vessels should be in the choroid. Now, it does happen to some people that blood vessels do grow up into the retina, and it produces vision deficits. Okay, and one powerful stimulator for the development of blood vessels is oxygen, the chemical compound oxygen, which is in our atmosphere. And some people are put in a very high oxygen concentration because their lungs aren't developed, or their lungs are failing. Okay. And does anybody know what kind of person I'm talking about? Like, for instance, yeah, premature baby, right? Might be put in an incubator because their lungs aren't developed. And doctors didn't really know this for a long period of time, but right when they started using incubators years later, these patients would grow up with vision deficits or even blind, because oxygen can diffuse through the cornea, through the anterior segment of the eye, and even the posterior segment of the eye through this vitreous humor, and it would run into the retina right here, which would then stimulate the growth of blood vessels from the cornea into the retina and push those photoreceptors out of the way. And of course, when you're an infant in an incubator, you couldn't tell anybody that, oh, I'm losing my vision, because at that stage you didn't even know you could see anything, right? Or should be looking at stuff. So we call that the retinopathy, which is a malformation of the retina or inflammation or degradation of the retina, right? A retinopathy of prematurity. So nowadays, doctors are always concerned about when somebody's lungs aren't developed to put them in an incubator with high oxygen to help them breathe, but not so high oxygen concentration that it stimulates the growth of blood vessels from the choroid into the retina. And you're probably wondering, well, gee whiz, that sounds like a really tough decision to make, right? That's right, and that's what doctors learn how to do in medical school, make those really tough decisions, always balancing what's going to help the patient more than harm the patient. We just call that clinical judgment, right? Okay, so remember, choroid has blood vessels, retina, no blood vessels. What else do we have right here? We have the optic nerve close to the posterior pole of the eye. Okay, just down below it. This is where the optic nerve attaches to the retina. And where it attaches, there can't be any photoreceptor cells. So indeed, you do have a blind spot right here. You have one blind spot in the right eye and one in the left eye. That blind spot is what we call the optic disc. And no one asked me to see that in lab. I don't want to do that in lecture. But in lab, if you want to see your blind spot, come up and I'll put a diagram on the board. And a part of that diagram will disappear if you position your head just right. Okay, that kind of underscores how important and how functional your brain is, because your brain is erasing that blind spot from your consciousness right now. It is there, but you just don't see it because you've lived your whole life not recognizing it. Your brain is erasing it. That's kind of funny that you're actually not seeing reality. You're seeing reality as you think it should exist. That's the power of the brain. Another example of the power of the brain, for instance, we can put a pair of glasses on your head like this that flip the world upside down, so that when you look around, where's the floor? The floor is going to be up there. And where's the ceiling? Down there. It's very disorienting. It's not fun to walk around like that, because you just, as a matter of fact, you might experience some severe nausea even when you do that. So I don't do it typically for students. All right, and then after you walk around for about 15 minutes, guess what your brain does? Even though you're still wearing the upside-down glasses, your reality gets flipped upside down so that it looks like it should, so that it relates to the rest of your body. So that's pretty freaky that your brain can do that. But that's still not the freaky part. You want to hear what the really freaky part is? If you take the glasses off but don't flip the image upside down, guess what happens? The world is now upside down for about a minute or two until your brain flips it back up the way it should be. So there's a lot of processing of visual information within the retina as well as in the brain, the occipital lobe of the brain. Okay, so retina right here for photoreceptors. There's that optic nerve. Here's that, one last thing, a couple specialized structures right here, right at the posterior pole of the eye. So light comes in through the cornea, through the lens, and the very center of the vision hits the retina right here. This is the most sensitive part of the retina in terms of producing color. This gives you your best color vision and your best acuity, the highest resolution images. Very nice high resolution. You can see fine detail in this area right here. Right, so the macula lutea is the central vision, and even in the center right here, this is the absolute best vision. That's in the fovea centralis. There are two kinds of cells that are in the retina. They have different kinds of functions. You have rods and cones. In the very center right here, you primarily have cone cells. Cone cells are small. They give you the perception of fine detail, but you can also see in color with cone cells. So when you look around, you can see blue and yellow. if light is, okay, falling right in this region right over here. The other kind of cell is a rod cell. Rod cell is a little bit bigger, and that is nice because since it's a bigger cell, it needs less light to become activated. So you can see in dim light with a rod cell. Cone cells, you need bright light because they're small. You need bright light for cone cells. Rod cells work in dim light, like at night. Okay, but with rod cells, you can only see in shades of gray or black and white, no color whatsoever. All right, and you can't see fine detail. Rod cells are in the peripheral vision. Okay, as you move away from the macula lutea and fovea centralis, the cone cells are replaced by rod cells. And some of you might have noticed that. Okay, maybe you're outside at night and you're looking up at the sky and you see a bunch of stars. Right? Some stars might disappear if you look right at them because the light from that star is shining right on the fovea centralis, which needs what kind of light in order to perceive it? It needs to be bright. But how bright is a starlight? It's really, really dim. Okay? So it will disappear, but then if you look to the side, off to the side of the star, so that instead of light falling on the fovea centralis right here, it falls in your peripheral vision, then guess what? You can see that star. But you probably can't tell what color it is as a result. If it's a really super bright star, like a blue or yellow one, you might be able to see it right here and you can actually tell the color. But a very dim white star, okay, you can only see with your peripheral vision and you probably won't even be able to tell what color it is. Okay, what are some other important structures besides these layers right here? Okay, here's the lens. The lens is important because it can change shape. Right, it has curvature to it, so it can bend light. In order for you to see a sharp image, the image has to be focused on the retina. It shouldn't focus in front or behind the retina because then it's going to look blurry, just like a regular photograph from a camera. So it's the job of the lens to focus light right on the retina and usually right here on the macula lutea. So depending on how far away the light is from your eye, it approaches the eye at different angles. If there's an object very close to you, light is diverging very sharply. The light rays are diverging. So the lens has to have a lot of curvature to bend the light back down so that it forms a nice point. Okay, but as the light diverges away, as you get farther and farther away from the object, the light rays are more parallel. It requires less bending to focus sharply on the retina right here. So the lens should be less curved. So the lens is changing shape all the time. So there's a muscle that changes the shape of the lens. We call it the ciliary body right here. It's a muscle and it's connected to the lens via these suspensory ligaments. Kind of a misnomer because maybe you would like to call that a tendon, but it's been called a ligament. Because what's a ligament? A bone-to-bone connection. Do you see any bones right here? No bones according to the classic definition, right? Okay. So that's the job of the lens. And what do we call that when the lens changes shape so that you can see close up or far away? We did that experiment in lab, right? When you put your finger up right here and you focused on your fingertip and your fingertip is nice and focused, but what about the background? It's all blurry. But if your fingertip is there and then if you focus on the background really nice and clear, what does your fingertip look like? It's all blurry, right? So it's only one distance at a time. And that process of changing your focus is what we call accommodation, and what's changing is the shape of the lens right here. Okay, there's something else that changes all the time inside your eye, and that is the iris. Right? It's mostly a circular smooth muscle that can constrict and dilate, and it changes the size of the foramen in the iris right here, which is what we call the pupil. And when the pupil is dilated, it lets a lot of light in. Like right now, your eyes are all dilated because this is a pretty interesting lecture and you're concerned and your eyes are dilated, right? Or what could possibly be maybe another reason? It's pretty dim in here, right? That's maybe another good reason why your eyes are dilated, okay? Now, if you were to walk outside, there's no clouds outside right now, what's going to happen to this pupil? It's going to get small, right? Because the iris constricts and it's going to let less light in, and that just protects the retina right here. Okay, so we see that the lens has curvature, but there is something else that light passes through that has curvature, and that is the cornea right here. The cornea is curved. That's the most important focusing element of the eye. It will bend light to focus on the retina. The lens can only make small corrections for distance, but it's the cornea that does most of the work for us. Okay, so this curvature has to, in order to see correctly, has to match up exactly to the distance from the cornea to the lens. And some people's eyeballs are too long, and they can't see close, they can't see clearly. Some people's eyeballs are too short, and again, they can't see clearly. So what somebody discovered not too long ago is that we can change the shape of the cornea so that it matches up with the distance from the retina right here, and guess what happens? Marvelous vision. Okay? Oh, let me get to astigmatism in just a little bit. Okay? Okay, so what's the name of that procedure where you can change the shape of the cornea right here? Without wearing glasses, you have perfect vision. That's that LASIK procedure. All right, so the LASIK procedure is ablating, actually flipping off this first little layer of epithelium from the eye, and then using a laser to blast away some of these cells right here, which changes the shape of the cornea, right? And then they put that flap of epithelium back on, and like within less than a second, you have better than perfect or perfect vision, right? 20/20 vision. The only thing is that it's a surgical technique, and things can go wrong. I guess it's not very often anymore that it goes wrong. So I don't recommend that procedure for cosmetic purposes because things can go wrong, and if something goes wrong, what happens? Well, that destroys your vision. That's a pretty important sense for you to have, right? And the other thing is the LASIK procedure will only work for that one point in time in your life. But what about your vision? Does it change from year to year? Yeah, it changes, right? And that LASIK procedure only will correct it for that one point in time. But I think now they might have some procedures to where they can do LASIK again and maybe even again and again if you want. But it used to be you could only get it one time. All right, so if your vision is so poor that you can't find your glasses in the morning, then LASIK is wonderful, right? Because you'll be able to see as soon as you wake up. You don't have to waste a half hour trying to find your glasses. Or if you're an athlete, it's great. But if you're just a normal guy like me, then it's really not such a big deal. It's safer for you to wear glasses because your glasses protect your cornea from damage, right? And that's really important because, remember, the fluid in the posterior segment right here is vitreous humor, which holds the retina up against the choroid. But what kind of fluid is in this anterior segment? It's aqueous humor. So if the cornea is damaged, that aqueous fluid just runs right out. All right, and there's nothing then that can separate the cornea from the iris, and they can touch. There's nothing separating the iris from the lens, and they can touch each other. And no one has ever figured out a way how to unstick these structures once they touch each other. They get stuck. But what's the really bad thing? What is the iris doing all day long? Is it just sitting there? So who cares if it gets stuck to something? What's the iris doing? It's moving all the time. Right? But if it's stuck to something, it can't move. What about the lens right here? Is it just sitting there? But what is it doing all day long? Yeah, it's changing shape. And if it's stuck to the iris or the cornea, it can't change shape. So somebody's vision is terribly disturbed or destroyed when these structures get stuck to each other. That's why I always recommend that you should forego that LASIK procedure and just wear glasses to protect your eyes, right? Especially if you ride a motorcycle or do other kinds of things. Okay. All right, so that goes over this figure pretty well. There's maybe some other things we could talk about. So remember, for focusing light on the eye, it requires the cornea. That's why I have an asterisk right there. And what else? Oh, there's no asterisk right here. Lens. Oh, I got a lens twice on here. There's only one lens in the eye. Okay, I don't know why there's two right there. Here's a lens with an asterisk on it. They work together to form a visual image, a focused visual image on the retina. All right, so make sure you know the difference between rod cells and cone cells. Okay, and then, so the rod cells and cone cells develop electrical information that gets sent to the brain via the optic nerve. What cranial nerve is the optic nerve once again? Yeah, it's number two. Okay, maybe I'll show you a picture. Here is what a rod cell looks like. Here's what a cone cell looks like. So you can see it's a little bit smaller. And these are the photoreceptors for vision. Let's see if I can say something about this. So here is just a picture of the retina with a really nice fancy camera. If we were to look into somebody's eye, it probably would never look quite as pretty as this. We would just be able to see one area at a time. But here is the optic disc. This is where the optic nerve attaches. There are blood vessels in the center of the optic nerve that go into the choroid, and we can see some blood vessels in the choroid right here. And here's the macula lutea. This looks like a pretty nice normal retina. If somebody has diabetes, there's going to be dark spots. There'll be places where the rod and cone cells are dead. That's why diabetes produces blindness eventually. All right, so this looks like a pretty nice retina. Also, if you experience trauma like a car accident or motorcycle accident, the retina can pull away from the choroid, which means that it pulls away from the blood vessels, and that part of the retina is going to die as well. That produces a retinopathy as well. Okay, so protect your head from trauma. So aqueous humor is produced by these ciliary processes that flow into the posterior chamber of the anterior segment of the eye. The anterior segment is just a chamber that's anterior to the lens, right? So the fluid moves from the ciliary process up along this posterior surface of the iris out through the pupil into the anterior chamber of the anterior segment of the eye and then into this scleral venous sinus. It's returned back to the circulatory system. All right, so there's a little bit of pressure in here that separates these structures, but it shouldn't be too high, because if there's high pressure in the anterior segment of the eye, it pushes the lens back, pressurizes the posterior segment, which then puts pressure on the retina, okay, which then forces blood out of the choroid. So now you don't have blood going into the choroid, and what does the retina need to stay healthy? It needs blood, but if blood isn't getting into the choroid, then the retina will actually begin to die because blood isn't getting into the choroid if there's too high a pressure in this anterior segment of the eye. And so every time you get your eyes checked for vision, they check this pressure right here. And what is the disease process that they're checking when they check the pressure right here? Because it produces blindness, which would be really unfortunate. That's glaucoma, right? With that little puff of air, they can watch and see how much the cornea deforms. If there's high pressure, the cornea won't bend at all. If there's normal pressure, then the cornea will bend just a little bit, and they can tell really nice without sticking like a pressure meter inside your eye. That would be really difficult to do. Okay. And ophthalmologists recommend that you undergo that procedure once a year, which probably nobody does. Okay. But glaucoma can sneak up on you. Okay, here is... We see a nice white sclera, okay? I see a little bit of an iris right here, and then I see the lens, but what can you tell me about this lens? Does not look transparent, right? It's opaque or translucent, and this is another disease process that can happen to the lens, and this is what we call a cataract, okay? So that happens, that's a normal part of aging. It just happens, especially if you're outside all the time in bright sunlight. So to protect yourself from that, just like wearing a hat, you should wear glasses, especially plastic lenses are the best. Glass lenses aren't so good, but hardly anybody buys glass lenses anymore. Okay, any kind of plastic will absorb ultraviolet light, which we can't see, but it can damage the lens right here. Okay, so let's see, what else do we want to talk about? The eye. Okay, the different layers of the eye can be categorized by some tunics, and a tunic is just like a coat. It's a covering. Okay, the fibrous tunic is made out of the sclera, and the cornea is part of the sclera, right? And the scleral venous sinus, right, which allows a drainage of aqueous humor from the eye. That's the fibrous tunic. The vascular tunic, what did we say, was the choroid. Okay, and ciliary body, and the iris is also part of the vascular tunic. And I see something right here, melanocyte. What do you know about a melanocyte? What is that? Is that a special name for a bone or ligament or what? It's a cell, right? It's a cell. What kind of cell is it? What does it produce? Melanin, and melanin is a pigment, right? It gives the choroid that dark appearance, and it helps absorb light so it doesn't flash around inside your eye. Okay, and then the sensory tunic. You have the neural layer, which has the photoreceptor cells, and even the retina has some pigments due to melanocytes in there, and that helps your acuity as well. Okay, visual pathways. This might help you a little bit in lab. Okay, so here you have the optic nerve, and here you have an eye, and then here are the visual fields. So this blue is your left visual field, and the yellow is your right visual field. All right, so that's going to then map to some nerve fibers in the optical pathway. These yellow fibers are carrying information from the right visual field, okay? And these blue fibers right here are from the left visual field, okay? And notice that some of these visual fields, the information from these visual fields, cross over. So here is the right, we're looking from the bottom. Okay, so here's the right eye. Okay, the right eye gets information from both the left and right visual field, and it enters through the optic nerve, right? It gets into the retina, then through the optic nerve, but right at the level of the optic chiasma, things get straightened out so that only information, right, from the left visual field enter the occipital lobe. So there's some crossover of information right here at the optic chiasma. Right, so all information from one visual field ends up in one occipital lobe, even though both eyeballs are seeing this visual field right here. Right, so some information crosses over. The same thing for the opposite track. So here is the optic track right here. It is only receiving information from, right, the right visual field, and it crosses over. And that's the job of the optic chiasma right there. All right, so I think that's it for the visual system. That takes us to the ear, right? And we got three senses for the ear. We've got hearing, okay? And then we have balance, and balance has two senses, static equilibrium and kinetic equilibrium. Right, y'all know what hearing is like, but what about this equilibrium? Static equilibrium, okay, is what we call linear, it's for linear acceleration, and kinetic equilibrium is for angular acceleration or spinning. And this helps us maintain our balance. And I'm going to talk about these maybe next time in class, maybe not today. But I just want to go over that a couple times, make sure that I don't forget about that. Okay, hearing. And is this a general or special sense? It's special, right? Because you can only hear with your ears. All right, so here's a pretty good picture in your book that gives you a little bit of an overview of an ear. And we can break the hearing apparatuses into three main compartments. You have an external ear, starting right here with the auricle or this flap of skin. Sometimes it's called the pinna. And there's a part over here that we call the helix. And then we got the lobe over here. Right, and then we got another part, sometimes we call this the tragus, maybe some of you that work in a hospital, okay, can notice the tragus and antitragus right here, not important for this class. And then that funnels sound energy into the external acoustic meatus, and you have an external acoustic meatus in which bone is this right here? Is it labeled? Hopefully it's not labeled. Good, it's not labeled. What bone is that? Yeah, it's a temporal bone, right? Okay, and this is not a canal, it's a meatus, because a canal means that there would be a hole going all the way through your head to your brain, because your brain is right on the other side of the temporal bone. But it's like a part of a canal that's closed. It's closed off right here at the tympanic membrane. All right, so the external ear stops at the tympanic membrane, and then it goes to the outside. So tympanic membrane then is the start of the middle ear. And inside the middle ear, there's a cavity that has some auditory ossicles. These are very small bones. There are three of them. And these conduct vibrations that are picked up by the tympanic membrane and carry them into the inner part of the ear, and in particular the cochlea that looks like a snail. So here is the inner part of the ear, the bony labyrinth that we call the cochlea, which is responsible for hearing. All right, and it needs to receive sound vibration. So these little, the tympanic membrane is right here, has a large surface area, and then that energy then vibrates another membrane at the entrance to the cochlea that we call the oval window. And why is it easy to see that this is an oval window right here? Because look at the shape of the footprint of the stapes. So this bone right here is the stapes, and what's the shape right here? Is that a triangle or a square? Or a rectangle, or a circle, or what? It's a nice oval. So that's the oval window. That's how sound energy enters the cochlea. All right, so this works as sort of like an amplifier. All right, so if you have a large surface area on the tympanic membrane, you take all of that energy and focus it into a small surface area, it means the amplitudes are higher over here. So it acts like an amplifier. And the arrangement of these bones also helps the transmission of sound because the inside of the cochlea right here is a fluid environment. It's a fluid. It's a watery environment. And out over here is just air. And what can you tell me about if you were talking to somebody, maybe you were in a pool and your friend was sitting on the deck of the pool and your head was above water and you were talking to him, could you hear your friend pretty easily? Yeah. Okay. Now put your head underwater and try talking to your friend. He's talking to you, could you hear him underwater? Not very well, because sound has difficulty entering water just because of the physical properties. So in order for sound to enter the fluid environment of the cochlea, it has to be, in a sense, amplified to get into the cochlea, and that's the job of the tympanic membrane being large and the round window here being relatively small, plus the arrangement of these bones. That's why you have a middle ear, just to get that sound energy without wasting much of it into the cochlea. Okay. And in order for you to hear, the tympanic membrane also has to vibrate back and forth. Okay. And sometimes it doesn't like to do that because maybe there's high pressure inside the middle ear. Maybe there's fluid inside the middle ear or maybe you're doing some scuba diving, for instance, and it presses up against the tympanic membrane. In order for the tympanic membrane to vibrate back and forth, the pressure in the external acoustic meatus has to be equal to the pressure in the middle ear right here. Because if the pressure in the middle ear is too high, it's going to press the tympanic membrane all the way out as far as it will go and just keep it there. We'll pin it to that extreme so that it can't vibrate back and forth. And if it can't vibrate back and forth, what do you hear? Nothing, right? Then you're deaf in that ear. So the pressure on either side of the tympanic membrane has to be the same. So that's why we have this pharyngotympanic tube or auditory tube, and it even has another name. Does anybody know another name for this auditory tube right here? It's called the Eustachian tube, starting with an E, E-U, Eustachian tube. All right, and it goes to your throat. Okay, and your throat is open to the air just like this external acoustic meatus is, so the pressure should be the same. Unless you have a little constriction of the auditory tube, like when you have a cold, for instance, right? Or maybe you change altitude very rapidly, like in an airplane, you take off and you get up really high altitude very, very fast. Pressure hasn't equalized, so there's high pressure, like sea level pressure in the middle chamber. And then you're at 10,000 feet or 20 or 30,000 feet very rapidly. You have very low pressure over here, right? So the tympanic membrane is pushed out. And then what do you have to do so that you can hear things normally again? You could like chew gum, or you could pressurize your throat by holding your nose, okay? Or wiggling your ear somehow, or, right, to open up this tube. And you might hear like a little wheezing sound, and you hear air flowing in or out of the middle chamber right here. And then all of a sudden, voila, what happens to hearing? It improves, right? Or maybe driving down from the mountains or some other kinds of examples. Okay. And if you have an infection of this middle chamber right here, which little kids are very prone to that, that's called otitis, because this is the otic area of your body. Remember, otic, and itis is inflammation, so otitis media is an inflammation of this middle chamber right here. And when somebody has otitis media, they can't clear their ears, they can't equalize the pressure of this tympanic membrane. So if you're driving through the mountains, little kids with otitis media are miserable because there are pain nerve endings in this tympanic membrane. Or if they're flying, they could be miserable because this tympanic membrane is being forced to one side or the other. Okay, so that's the middle part of the ear. Let's look at the cochlea in particular. What should we be talking about? Oh, let's make sure you know the auditory ossicles, where are those located. Okay, we said here is the stapes, right? Here is the incus, and here is the malleus, right here, right? And they just amplify sound so that it can enter the cochlea very, very nicely. There are some muscles that in the middle ear that attach to these auditory ossicles that help protect extremely loud sounds from being transmitted from the outside of your ear into the cochlea, because loud sounds can damage the cochlea. So for instance, I know on the way home, I listen to the radio in my car, and then after about 2 miles, what do? I can't hear it quite well enough because of the road noise, so what do? I turn it up, okay? And then after a little while, what happens? I turn it up some more, right? And then after a little while, what do most people do? Turn it up a little bit more, right? I get home, I turn the car off, and then in the morning, I get into the car and turn the car on, and how does the music sound? Like it's blasting. It's like one of my wild nephews borrowed my car overnight, and I didn't know about it or something, okay? Well, what happens is, as you make the sound, the music louder and louder and louder, the stapedius muscle right here to the stapes, right, in the tensor tympani, contract, and it dampens the vibrations in the auditory ossicles, protecting your inner ear from damage. Okay, and then when you walk in from a quiet environment, when these muscles aren't contracted, then the music sounds really painfully loud. Okay. All right, so there's some muscles in your inner ear for that. Okay, let's look at this. All right, so here we see that snail-shaped structure, okay, and it's inside a bony labyrinth that we call the cochlea, right, and that's for hearing. Here's the stapes with the oval window right below, so sound energy enters, and it runs around through the cochlea, and it doesn't stay inside the cochlea, because if it did, then it would break the cochlea. It could shatter different parts of the hearing apparatus. So that energy flows in through one tube and then flows across the hearing apparatus into a second tube, and it takes that energy back out to another window that we call the round window, which is about in this location right here. Do we have a picture of a round window anywhere? Ah, here it is right here. All right, so energy enters the oval window and it leaves the round window right here after rolling through the cochlea. All right, so here is, oh, you can't see it. I'll bring it over for you to see in just a second. Okay, so here's the oval window, here's the round window, here's the cochlea. Now, what's happening to the cochlea in this circumstance? It is like unrolling, okay? And that's because the cochlea is acting like a musical instrument. One part of the cochlea can sense high frequencies, and the other end can sense low frequencies, right? And what kind of instrument does that remind you of? If we were to unroll this cochlea, what kind of instrument plays high frequencies on one side and low frequencies on the other side? Like a piano, right? So think of this cochlea as containing a piano, and that organ, right, for sensing different frequencies is what we call the organ of Corti. It's in this chamber right here. And it basically works like a piano. So in each temporal bone inside the cochlea, you have a piano, okay, that can sense different sounds by their particular frequency. So this end over here can sense high frequencies. Toward the tip of the cochlea, which we call the helicotrema, can sense low frequencies. And how does a piano work? The cochlea works just the same way. How does a piano make different notes? What can you tell me about low frequencies coming from a piano? What can you tell me about the thing inside the piano that makes a low frequency? It's a string. And what about the nature of the string? It's really thick and it's long, right? So that will vibrate at a low frequency. And high frequencies will vibrate with strings that are what? Really thin and short. The same thing about the organ of Corti inside the cochlea. The thing that is really long and thick is located out here by the helicotrema. The structure of the organ of Corti, which is really thin and narrow, is over here closest to the round window. It doesn't look like it on this diagram, so let me pull up this diagram right here. Okay, so here's the helicotrema. If we were to look down from the top, we would see that this is the widest part of the cochlea. And then as we move away further and further and further, what's happening to the cochlea? It's getting thinner and thinner and thinner, and here's the thinnest region right here. It's hard to appreciate on these illustrations, but this is the widest part of the cochlea. Here's the thinnest part. So the widest will be sensitive to low frequencies, and the thinnest part will be sensitive to high frequencies. Okay, so here is that piano. Now, why is it rolled up inside the temporal bone? Yeah, for space, because, well, it would just be really funny to have us walking around with pianos sticking out of our ears, right? So it's rolled up so that it fits inside our temporal bone. Okay, so there are three main chambers, right? Here is one. This is what we call the scala vestibuli. This is where sound enters, all right? And then it goes through this chamber right here, which is what we call the cochlear duct. And then it exits the ear through this chamber right here, which is what we call the scala tympani. So vestibuli is on the top, the cochlear duct in the middle, and the tympani down here on the bottom. The tympani is connected to the round window that lets that sound energy leave the ear. All right, so let's look at, in particular, okay, what those chambers look like. So here's the vestibuli. This is connected to the oval window. It contains a fluid that we call perilymph. And there's perilymph down in the scala tympani. That's the chamber connected to the round window. This is how sound exits. And then the cochlear duct right here has a fluid that's kind of similar, but it's called endolymph. All right? And these fluids right here shouldn't contain any kind of red blood cells or white blood cells or anything like that, just a nice clear fluid. And within the cochlear duct that's surrounded by endolymph, you can see endolymph right here, there is a tectorial membrane, and this tectorial membrane can vibrate, right? And the big, thick tectorial membranes vibrate at a low frequency if it's at the helicotrema, or this tectorial membrane is really thin if it's near the round window, vibrates at a high frequency. So it's going to vibrate back up and down. Let's zoom into this region right here. So where is this region located? Ah, here. Okay, so here's that tectorial membrane. And on the bottom of the organ of Corti is the basilar membrane. And then we have some hair cells right here because they have cilia poking up off of them. And again, you need a microscope to see these kinds of things. These are the sensory receptor cells for hearing. Because when the tectorial membrane vibrates back and forth, it's connected to these stereocilia right here, and that causes a change in the electrical properties of these hair cells, and that electrical property then is transmitted to the brain via the cochlear nerve, right, to the auditory cortex inside the brain, which is in the temporal lobe. Okay? All right, so the sense of hearing is a result of stimulating these hair cells. And they're called hair cells not because they produce hair that's on your head, but because of what? Of these cilia that are connected to the tectorial membrane that vibrates back and forth. All right, so this right here is typically what we call the organ of Corti that's inside the cochlear duct. And the receptor cells are hair cells. All right, that's kind of a funny name for them because you wouldn't really think that hearing had anything to do with hair cells, but indeed, these are the names of the cells that produce the sense of hearing. Okay, so that is the sense of hearing. Those hair cells are inside the cochlear duct right here. All right, so you should know vestibuli, tympani, and cochlear duct. And the organ for hearing is in the cochlear duct. Anybody remember the name of that organ for hearing? Is the organ of Corti. Organ of Corti. And what are the names of the receptor cells within the organ of Corti? They are hair cells. Yeah, it's kind of a funny name for them, hair cells. All right, so sign-in sheet is going around. When we come back next week, we're going to talk about the other senses, not for hearing, because hearing has to do with the organ of Corti, but the equilibrium senses in the vestibule and the semicircular canals. So vestibule and semicircular canals are the bony labyrinth. They're the counterparts to the cochlea, which is the bony labyrinth for hearing. And then we'll be done with special senses. All right, this lecture recorded.